The Guardian.
Hello, this is Hannah Devlin, one of the presenters of The Guardian's Science Weekly podcast. Before we start this week's episode about this month's historic lunar landing, let me take a minute to tell you about Guardian Jobs, which is sponsoring this episode of the podcast. It's always nice to get on with the people you work with. Guardian Jobs can help you find your good company. It promotes a world of work where potential flourishes by connecting people with rewarding careers at like-minded organisations where values make a difference. It makes it easy to find roles that are relevant to your sector, location and seniority level. So you can trust Guardian Jobs to help you find a role where you can make a difference for yourself and your employer. And if you're a recruiter looking to attract a diverse candidate pool who share progressive values and are engaged with the world around them, trust Guardian Jobs to help you fill your vacancies with people who want to make a difference. So find your good company at gu.com/goodcompany. Now let's get on with this week's episode. Have you ever listened to the Pink Floyd album Dark Side of the Moon? It was released in the early 1970s, less than 5 years after the first human had set foot on the near side of the moon.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
The album was a huge success, selling more than 45 million copies worldwide. It came at a time, however, when popularity for exploring the actual moon was waning. Fast forward to January 2019, and a Chinese spacecraft became the first ever to land on the far side of the moon, taking a historic step into uncharted territory.
I'm really happy that this worked out so nicely. It's really a big achievement.
The Chang'e 4 probe is the latest in a series of lunar missions from the Chinese Space Agency, which is hoping to soon put humans back on the moon. And they are not alone. The United States, Russia, and Europe are also showing a renewed interest and looking at how the moon's untapped resources may one day be useful to lunar settlers.
What we do know is that if we ever want to live and work in a sort of permanent and economically viable and sustainable way off Earth, then this requires that we learn to use the resources that we find there.
Despite what Pink Floyd's album implies, the far side of the moon is actually no darker than the near side. But we are learning that there are important differences between the two sides. So what can the far side tell us that the near side hasn't already? How might this latest mission fit into the general renaissance in lunar exploration? And when might we see the first long-term human settlement on the moon?
Within our lifetimes, probably yes.
I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly. The Chang'e 4 spacecraft touched down on the lunar far side in the South Pole Aitken Basin region, which is the oldest known impact crater in the solar system. The area is of special interest to lunar scientists, as it is thought to date back to a period in the early solar system when asteroids rained down on the inner planets and their moons. The very ancient material found inside these craters could contain clues about the moon's formation. Hi Martin, it's Hannah here.
Yes, hello Hannah.
How are you doing?
Oh well, it's exciting time, so...
Yeah. I wanted to learn more about the Chang'e 4 mission and its goals. So I spoke to Martin Visa, a senior scientist at the Swedish Institute of Space Physics. Martin led the team that built one of the instruments that just landed on the moon with the Chinese probe. I started off by asking him what's so special about the far side of the moon.
Well, the far side looks very different from the near side. On the near side, we have this large, rather flat areas, mare. When you look at the moon, it's these darker areas, which are lava flows, which came later in the lunar formation, which covered whatever was there in a sort of a uniform, with a uniform layer of material.
And those dark areas, is that what you see when you see the sort of face in the moon, when you look up at
it? Yes, exactly. So on the dark side, those don't exist. So on the far side, it's just craters, if I can say so. And because of that, there is much older material exposed to the surface.
So for some reason, that lava hasn't flown over the the craters and covered the more ancient craters.
Yes, these lava flows didn't happen on the far side. And the obvious question is why? And that's actually a very difficult one. So I don't know the answer to it. And that's one of the reasons why it's very interesting to go and see on the far side how the material actually looks like and how the situation is at the surface.
One of the major challenges with the Chang'e 4 mission is that direct communication with the far side of the moon is impossible. So the Chinese team had to use what's known as a relay satellite to get messages back and forth from their probe. This satellite is situated beyond the moon in such a position that it can see both the probe on the far side of the moon and tracking systems back on Earth. Despite having the help of this relay station, the rocky terrain on the moon meant that the final descent and landing of the probe were tricky. There was only so much that scientists on Earth could control.
So a large part of the landing sequence is autonomous, especially the hazard avoidance. So one should imagine, as it approaches the surface, there are craters on the surface and rocks and everything, and one should not land with one leg on a rock and the other leg in a crater. So one has to find a place where it's flat on a very, very local scale. And for this, the lander moves in at a certain altitude. It started to do laser scanning of the surface to get altitude profiles, and then also to calculate the hazards where rocks are and where one should not land. And then the system decides basically where a reasonably flat area is, and then slowly lowers down on that region. And then a few meters above the surface, the main engine is cut off, and the lander basically falls the last few meters freely to the lunar surface.
After the landing, the rover on board was deployed onto the lunar surface, and it turns out that the rover's lifestyle on the moon is pretty interesting.
Currently, the rover is in a so-called hibernation mode during the lunar noon, and it will wake up again when the sun gets a bit down, when the thermal environment presumably is no longer so extreme, and it will wake up to the point where the sun will set. And then it will hibernate again throughout the lunar night until the next lunar day starts again.
So it just works in the afternoon, is that right?
One can say the rover is operated in the morning and in the afternoon.
With a nap in the middle?
With a nap during noon, and of course it sleeps during the night.
Sounds like quite a good lifestyle.
Yeah, what one should not forget is that the day is 2 weeks long.
Right.
So... Well, as lifestyle, it's a tough morning and a tough afternoon.
As I mentioned before, one of the main reasons for sending a probe to the far side of the moon was to learn about its composition.
We have a very fairly good understanding of the composition of the lunar near side, where we have even got samples back from the moon during the Apollo missions, for example. But on the far side, this knowledge is much more limited. And this measurement of the composition, especially in such an old crater, I think this will give new clues about how the moon formed and how the moon evolved.
Astronomers are also looking to exploit the lack of noise on the far side of the moon.
It's a new window to the universe, which is a window which is very dirty on Earth because, well, signals have to be very strong to be able to get through the noise we create ourselves. But on the, if you are on the far side of the moon, then all this human noise is not there and one gets much, much more sensitive measurements.
And is the idea that you could have an actual telescope on the far side one day?
Yeah, so that's one of the ideas, to study this type of frequency ranges which are long polluted on Earth, that you go to the lunar far side and put a larger radio astronomy instrument there, where it's quiet and no one else makes noise.
Martin's own instrument, which has the snappy name of the Advanced Small Analyzer for Neutrals, is measuring how the solar wind interacts with the lunar surface. This is particularly interesting because it could help explain one of the most unexpected findings of recent years, which is that there is water on the moon.
And then comes, of course, the immediate question, how was it possible to get there, and how can it stay there? So the only way to investigate further is go to the moon and actually measure on the surface how this process works. And our instrument is doing that.
The logic is that the stream of charged particles coming from the sun, which is known as the solar wind, is mostly made up of hydrogen. And the minerals in the lunar surface contain oxygen. So the reaction between these two things could be making water. These kind of findings could have practical uses too. In 2017, China announced its ambition to send astronauts to the moon. As space agencies are considering the prospect of long-term human settlements on the moon, one problem that needs solving is where astronauts are going to get water from.
If one considers a manned base on the moon, it's very important to understand how the environment looks like, how it behaves, and what resources this environment can provide. And every bit which you can extract from the moon, you don't have to carry to the moon. And as carrying things to the moon is very expensive, for example, one can extract water from the lunar regolith. That's a big advantage.
And do you think it might be possible? I read that there's only about, you know, to get a glass of water, you'd have to be harvesting from, you know, a kind of gigantic field of moon. Would it be possible to do that?
Pure scale-wise, I mean, a glass of water from, we usually use a tennis court size area and a glass of water, that's not so much area. I mean, if you compare what is done when people are mining for gold, they move much larger amounts of material to get some few grams out of it. So that in itself is not really the difficult bit. The difficult bit is maybe that one has to move this stuff around on the moon. And there we are not there technically to do it.
A mini lunar greenhouse was also deployed on the rover, acting as the first test to see if humans might be able to grow their own food on the moon. And whilst we're still a long way off actually having long-term human settlement on the moon, Martin has no doubt that it'll happen. It's more a question of when than if.
I think this is very well formulated. Within our lifetimes, probably yes.
Who do you think will get there first?
Well, the way it looks like, it's Chinese.
As I mentioned, the Chinese aren't the only ones in this 21st century space race. And after the break, we'll look at why space agencies across the globe are intent on putting humans back on the moon.
We see plans from a number of private companies, private organisations who plan to build their own lunar landers and to fly there in the next years, with the first ones we'll see in the next few months, I expect, of these missions.
We'll be right back.
Today in Focus is a new Guardian podcast that brings you closer to our journalism by getting behind the news every weekday. You'll join me, Anushka Astana, talking to people at the centre of the big stories impacting our world. We'll use personal perspectives and expert analysis to put you at the heart of what matters. Listen to Today in Focus and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you choose to listen.
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Hannah Devlin. Before the break, Martin Wieser told us about the Chang'e 4 mission that saw a Chinese spacecraft land on the far side of the moon, a historic moment for lunar exploration. He told us about the science that the probe is carrying out, including his own instrument, which he hopes could offer clues into how water forms on the moon. Martin believes these insights could pave the way to the first long-term human settlement on the moon. But why is it now that scientists are all vying to learn more about the moon, a full half century after the golden age of lunar exploration?
My name is James Carpenter, and I'm a strategy officer for the Directorate of Human and Robotic Exploration in the European Space Agency.
Everyone still talks about the moment that Neil Armstrong stepped out of Apollo 11 and became the first person ever to walk on the moon's surface 50 years ago.
Surface is fine and buttery. I can pick it up loosely with my toe.
It will forever be an iconic moment in space exploration. But soon after Armstrong got back to Earth, the desire to send more people up there faded.
So the Apollo program that put humans on the moon in the 1960s was a quite extraordinary event. Going from almost nothing to humans on the moon in less than a decade was really quite something. And it was possible because of a very particular set of geopolitical circumstances and things that were perceived to be important at the time by the people who made decisions. So it wasn't a program that was motivated by science. It was motivated by other things. And once that program had achieved its goal, which was to put humans on the surface of the moon, it had achieved its mandate, the rationales for its continuance reduced, public interest in the novelty of having humans on the moon reduced, and there were other areas which were demanding of the resources that were being used. So the emphasis changed at that point. So there was a period of quite some years where not a lot was happening.
Considering what we've just seen from the Chang'e 4 mission, are we now living through a renaissance in lunar exploration? It's something I put to James.
We've had a few missions to the moon, orbital missions, over the last few years, and these have really given us a new perspective on the moon and a different context for what we thought we knew already from the Apollo missions that came before. And so that's really changed our perspective. At the same time, we've had scientists going back to the samples that came from Apollo with new technologies, new equipment, and they're discovering new things that we never were able to find before using the Apollo samples. And so our understanding of the science of the moon has changed a lot, and the rationales for going back have increased.
As James explained, some also see the moon as the best place to test our ability to survive for long periods in space.
Before you want to think about sending humans off to Mars, you really have to have human exploration of the moon to learn what it means to live and work there. And we're also learning that the moon is probably the first place in the cosmos where we can start to work out what it means to live and work using the resources that we find locally. And so this is also something we need to learn before we can move onwards into the solar system.
China, among others, have stated that they have an ambition to put humans back on the moon. But leading up to that, there are a whole series of other missions planned. What are some of the most exciting missions that are coming up to the moon from the different space agencies?
So here in ESA, we're working on a number of missions which could help us to access and to learn more about the moon and how we can live and work there. We're working with NASA on the Orion vehicle. So Orion is the first vehicle since Apollo that will take humans into deep space, into lunar vicinity. And it'll be the Orion vehicle that eventually takes crews to a place called the Gateway, which is going to be developed over the next decade. And from there, we will access the lunar surface. We're also working with Russia on their mission Luna 27. This is a mission which will land in the polar regions of the moon, where we will use access that place very precisely using a system called Pilot, which is European. And then there we will drill into the surface in the polar regions, extract samples and analyze them to understand the science that they can bring, but also how we might use the resources that we find there in the future. And that's going to be done with a package called Prospect, which we're developing.
And like all popular trends, lunar exploration is now something that private companies are looking to capitalize on.
We see plans from a number of private companies, private organizations who plan to build their own lunar landers and to fly there in the next years, with the first ones we'll see in the next few months, I expect, of these missions. And these companies see longer term business cases, being able to sell access to the lunar surface, and they're being supported by NASA. And we in ESA are also creating partnerships with some private companies in Europe to try and help them to access the moon and to realise their own commercial ideas at the lunar surface in ways that will benefit European taxpayers.
What is the commercial value in going to the moon?
So that's something that I think is being explored, and there are different kinds of business cases and different kinds of customers. I think it's probably fair to say that the primary customer for the foreseeable future will be governments, agencies, institutional customers. There are also some innovative models. So there are companies that will fly the ashes of your dead loved ones to the moon for a fee. There are a number of companies that are interested in the potential use of the resources of the moon, so water, ice, and other things that maybe can be used to support exploration.
We've mentioned a little bit the idea that there's new scientific motivations for going back to the moon, but that's not all of it, is it? There's this desire to be able to exist independently in space and to sort of use and mine the resources that we find when we arrive there. Is that what's really driving this kind of renewed interest in returning to the moon and having manned missions to the moon?
I think there is a long-term motivation, which is about sustained and sustainable human presence in space. And what we do know is that if we ever want to live and work in a sort of permanent and economically viable and sustainable way off Earth, then this requires that we learn to use the resources that we find there. And actually, we do this already. So nearly all spacecraft use solar power. And this is an example of taking a resource that we find in space, sunlight, and turning it into something that we want, which is energy. And so this is a, you're looking at how can we expand that model of operations to other ways.
I mean, I think most people can totally get the excitement of going somewhere and exploring it for the first time. But the idea of existing there for a long period, it seems maybe less exciting and more just extremely hard work when you've got water and oxygen and everything you need here. All of those things are so complicated on the moon compared to on Earth. Why do we want to do that?
If at some point in the future you were to have lunar surface infrastructure, like a lunar base or something, then people there might work there for longer periods of time. But it's not clear whether that would be, or what the kind of durations people would be there for would be. It'd probably look a little bit like the International Space Station, where we have increments where people would spend a few months at a time in a location living and working and doing science. But actually, what I would love to see happen, during my career, low Earth orbit has gone from being somewhere you go to explore to being somewhere you go to work, to do science and things like that. And I would love to see it, a situation where the surface of the moon went from being somewhere we go to explore to being somewhere we go to work to do science and things like that, in a kind of a semi-permanent infrastructure. I think that would be a fabulous thing to happen.
Society is currently grappling with how to rectify some of the environmental damage we've caused on planet Earth. But landing probes on once untouched rock surfaces, building lunar bases, and potentially mining for untapped resources, all of these things have the potential to destroy the pristine nature of the surface we're so keen to explore.
I think something we've learned from working on Earth is that we have to learn how to manage resources in a sustainable and ethical way. And so I think that this is something that is certainly going to be a part of the discussion in how we do this in a way that is responsible in the future, and how we create the rules and the governance and the legal frameworks that ensure that we do that. So yes, that is certainly a consideration in the way we plan how we do these things.
The International Space Station is one example of a project that brought together global space agencies for the greater goal of space exploration. But some see the Chang'e 4 mission as an indication that China is out in front with regards to putting humans back on the moon. So does the moon have the potential to be a source of geopolitical rivalry once again?
So while everybody is interested in understanding what their part's going to be and to find the parts that are attractive from a commercial or from an economic perspective, we are in an environment where we will depend on each other. As the way we explore space is changing, as we start thinking about using space resources, for example, there are some new legal and governance challenges that have not been addressed before or have needed to be addressed before. And so this will be something that we as an international community have to deal with in the coming years.
Thank you to Martin Visa and James Carpenter for joining us this week. You can find out more about the lunar mission on our website, guardian.com/podcasts. This week's episode was presented by me, Hannah Devlin, and produced by Danielle Stevens. If you want to get in touch with us, you can just email scienceweekly@theguardian.com. But for now, I'm off to plan my trip to the moon. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.